to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Thanks for tuning in. On the show today, we'll hear an interview with Bobby Dennis from Access, and he'll be talking about efforts to prevent violence against women. We'll also hear from Dr. Diana Cochran about growing hops in Iowa. We'll have a phenology from our resident naturalist, Pat Schlauerbaum. And in the last segment, we'll be joined by Crystal Davis from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau to discuss the Community Grants Program. Last week's summer-like weather finally ended on Friday, and the weekend was a lovely weekend that felt more like fall. That weather will continue. Today will be sunny with a high of around 80 degrees, but then the temperatures will dip tomorrow and will be cooler the rest of the week. From Tuesday right into next weekend, highs will only be in the 60s and nighttime temperatures may go down into the 40s. Tuesday will bring a chance of a thunderstorm and showers will be possible from Thursday through Sunday. So cooler temperatures and fall weather are finally here and just in time because fall started on September 21st. We won't be having our usual news segments this week because Dennis Hart is on his way to California, where he will spend the next few months. However, starting next week, once he gets settled in, he will be sending us his news summaries from there. So we'll start airing them again beginning next Monday. One thing that has surely been in the news in the past few weeks is violence against women, with the murders of Molly Tibbetts and Celia Arozamena and the charges of sexual assault against Brett Kavanaugh. Bobby Dennis from Access knows these issues well. He is a male outreach and engagement specialist for Access Support Center for victims of sexual violence and domestic abuse. He serves male victims of sexual violence, and in addition, he provides community education and outreach. Much of Bobby's work is focused on preventing violence. KHOI reporter Joy Beadleston spoke with him about his work in reducing and preventing violence against women.
Can you expand on the work in male engagement?
Rather than thinking about men as perpetrators, we're really focusing on engaging men in terms of bystanders and in terms of challenging some of the systems that really promote and encourage sexual assault and domestic violence. So how do we get more men involved in violence prevention efforts and give them the tools to challenge their peers and their communities around sexual assault and domestic violence? And the reality is we live in a society that really promotes rape culture, really promotes sexual assault through many different means. And so what we do with male engagement work is really trying to encourage men to, A, take a look at themselves and some of the things that they take part in that influences violence against women, but also outwardly focusing on their communities. How do they challenge things inside of their communities? So we do that access through a few different ways. We're really focusing right now on a program inside of fraternities called Building Up Brothers. We adapted Building Up Brothers from a program Coaching Boys and Men, which is focused on engaging coaches to talk to their teams, players, about violence against women and respectful behavior. So we've utilized that in the past, and then we adapted it. How it functions is that we send older members, like presidents, risk management chairs, through a training, and then every week that they will end up training their fraternities as a whole.
And how's that going?
Really well. We are actually on year three now. I've heard from a lot of fraternities that they've seen the impact on their fraternity as a whole and how that started to shape some of their culture. Previously, we actually ran Coaching Boys and Men at Marshalltown Community College with their athletic teams, and we also did a lot of fraternity work here at Iowa State. And so we try to figure out, like, how do we consistently give tools to older members to be able to challenge their peers and challenge their younger members to think about these issues? I've really enjoyed being able to train those fraternities and work with those fraternities. Yeah, it's been a really good experience as a whole.
Sounds like a positive influence on the community. Mm-hmm. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair to say. And what I've witnessed more and more is that Building Up Brothers is really focused on how do we create a consistent atmosphere and how do we set up expectations inside of that fraternity about what does it mean to prevent violence against women. The reality is that because of stereotypes that are created about fraternities, we actually have a lot of freshmen that come in that want to join fraternities because they think it's going to be all partying and
the Animal House type.
Yeah, yep, exactly, the Animal House stereotypes. What this program has allowed us to do is really give some of those fraternities tools to be able to create a supportive environment and create an environment that really prevents sexual violence.
I would think it would be hard to go into a fraternity thinking it might be like an Animal House. I would think you would feel pressure.
Yeah, we're talking about a system where sometimes people feel like, oh, these are the expectations, and I can't say anything because of these expectations. And really what programs like Building Up Brothers do is allows fraternities to set really clear expectations about what they expect and also give a pass to be able to say, like, hey, I'm not okay with this.
Anybody in particular come to you that gave you feedback that you really are making a difference? Have you had feedback like that?
There was two times where I really felt like, wow, we're actually making some pretty good steps. One of the fraternities have consultants from the national fraternities help educate each chapter. Their leadership consultant really was trying to consider, like, how do we influence other of our chapters to implement this at other schools, which was really nice that not only does it prove to be, like, a really good program for ISU, but there are other campuses that are also considering, you know, what does it look like to implement this. And the other place where I felt personally connected to and happy with the success and growth of it is I was doing closing interviews regarding Building Up Brothers and how it went with the fraternity that I am an alumni of. And they shared with me that there was a situation that could be deemed harassing behavior. There was a younger member that was really just not in the point of, like, had assaulted anyone or where it got to the point where the action was illegal, but the action was definitely uncomfortable. There was a young woman that went to them and said, like, hey, I'm just uncomfortable with the advances that are happening. And they were able to have a really good conversation with him about his behavior and also what it meant to really kind of take rejection well, which I think is one of the things that a lot of fraternities are finding this really valuable, to be able to challenge some of their members using language that they haven't been able to before. Because harmful behavior from men isn't just sexual assault. Sometimes it's sexual harassment. Sometimes it's mean rejection. Well, it's blaming someone if they're not interested in you. We want to challenge them across all of these different behaviors to be able to grow as men that have a good understanding of what it means to treat women as equal. And people feeling like they can hold their friends, their family members, their loved ones accountable for their behaviors. I've had friends in the past where they weren't taking rejection well, or they were saying some things that were really harmful. It was my responsibility to challenge them as somebody that cared for them and that really cared for them to be able to grow as healthy men. And so we want to give the community some of those tools to challenge peer behavior. Because something that not necessarily, there may be situations where counseling is needed, but sometimes it's just having another person say this isn't acceptable.
So if you have people that want to be leaders now and teach this in other areas of their community, when they go out there in the world and say, you know what, I should take this with me and maybe start something. Have you had that type of feedback?
Yeah, start to teach and do some of that education work around prevention across so many different life stages and environments. And some of it is just giving fraternities just a really good base understanding of what healthy relationships look like and what unhealthy relationships look like. And those are things that, regardless of if you're in a fraternity or if you're on an athletic team or if you're in your 50s and working in an office space, having those tools to be able to engage in conversations about healthy and unhealthy relationships.
Hope that it continues creating something healthy and training people in how to have healthy relationships and interactions. So thank you. And what made you want to get into this work?
Yeah, I think that there were a lot of things that led to this work. When I think about the understanding of sexual assault and domestic violence, as kids we were always pretty aware because of different family members that were really impacted by domestic violence and sexual assault. And as a result of that, my dad always did a really good job talking to me and my brother and sister about domestic violence and sexual assault, and specifically prevention, and take a role when it comes to preventing violence.
And to end the interview, I'd like to ask you, what do you want to communicate to the community about what they could do to make a difference in the future to change the culture and help with access and what they're up to?
And I think a lot of it comes down to sexual assault is not just a personal issue. Historically, we've looked at this and said, okay, well, somebody's a perpetrator. That person is wrong. They're just so different from what the norm is. But the reality is much different. This isn't one person with a psychological issue that is assaulting people. This is a society as a whole, a culture that influences men to think of women as lesser and influences them to believe that they're entitled to any women they want to be with. And so I think that what I try to encourage is people to think of, like, how are they interacting with that? Really start thinking about how we all interact, right? What are some of the things that you're doing that promotes rape culture, right? Promotes violence against women.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
That was Bobby Dennis, Male Outreach and Engagement Specialist for Access Assault Care Center, extending shelter and support. Bobby was describing the innovative programming he is leading to reduce and prevent violence against women with a program in ISU fraternities called Building Up Brothers. In the wake of the violent murder of Celia Barkin Arozamena, Iowa Professor of Sociology Liana Buffard spoke to the Iowa State Daily. She pointed out men's current lack of accountability in violence against women, saying, "This is an issue of male entitlement and toxic masculinity without easy answers." She noted that there's a lot of work to be done. So in ending violence against women, this program at Access can make a huge difference in environments many find toxic masculinity thrives. This program is working successfully and can provide hope and healing. It gives me hope because peer-to-peer education and accountable and compassionate male leadership are peaceful and permanent solutions. I'm Joy B., reporter for KHOI.
This one goes out to the ones in need. This one goes out to the sinner and the cynical. This ain't about no apology. This road was paved by the hopeless and the hungry. This road was paved by the winds of change. Walking beside the guilty and the innocent. How will you raise your hand when they call your name? Yeah, yeah. We weren't born to follow. Come on and get up off your knees. When life is a bitter pill to swallow, you gotta hold on to what you believe. Believe that the sun will shine tomorrow, and that your saints and sinners bleed. We weren't born to follow. You gotta stand up for what you believe.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI. That was We Weren't Born to Follow by Bon Jovi. When people think of Iowa crops, they usually think of corn and soybeans. But there is another crop that Diana Cochran would like to see become more common on Iowa farms. She is an assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, and one of the areas that Dr. Cochran works in is growing hops. I asked her first to explain what hops is.
Most people know hops from thinking about it for the use in beer. So it's a vine crop, and people will classify it as an herb, or basically because it is kind of the fruiting body of the plant, then that's where it kind of falls into my area of expertise. But mostly hops are used in the flavoring of beer. So either going to give it for the flavoring, so the aroma compounds, or bittering, which again would be more of the flavoring, but it's either uses aroma or bittering.
Hops, you said they're a vine, so that means they're a perennial?
Yeah, it's a perennial. And so basically you hope it lasts anywhere up to 20 years being productive. It will last longer than that. There's certainly hops that have been grown in the wild for, you know, many, many years beyond that. But typically in a lot of our fruit crops, we hope that they'll be yielding full production for around 20, 25 years. Basically, you know, every year the plant grows 18 feet tall. It grows on a twine that's hooked to the trellis. The top of the trellis has a wire. At around 18 feet is about the minimum that you want to have that wire from the ground to the top. And then you essentially string twine from the base, so from the ground level to the top of the trellis, and then that's what the hop plant wraps around and grows. And so that happens every spring. This year, since we had a long winter, and then we went essentially straight into kind of the hot summer. So this year it took about, when by the time they started coming up in the spring to the time they reached the top of the trellis, we're looking at about, it was around 7 weeks. You want the plant to reach the top of the trellis at summer solstice, right around that top, is when you want it to time out. And that way, within the next 7 days, it goes from vegetative to reproductive. And so that's kind of your timeline. Now, depending on, you know, what kind of spring we have, sometimes we have growth, you know, sooner. Sometimes they'll start sprouting in March or April, and then we have to basically cut them back over time.
Oh, because you don't want them to get too high too quickly.
Right. If they get too high too quickly, then they will basically start growing over and kind of downward, and that's where then they essentially kind of become stressed, and it's not only a tangled mess, so when it comes to harvest, it's kind of a mess to deal with then, but they will also sometimes start flowering early. And then that's what you don't want, because you're not going to have a consistent, you know, maturity of the cones.
And what family are they in? Is hops in?
So hops are in the Cannabaceae family.
Oh,
so it's, and that's where I think a lot of interest also kind of piques people's interest with it, since it's in the same family. The scientific name for hops is Humulus lupulus, and then there's different varieties of that. But most of the cultivar, or most of the plants that you see growing, especially on the commercial side, are all cultivars that have been, you know, bred through either private breeding programs or the USDA's breeding program.
And is it a fruit that you're actually harvesting?
Yeah, you're harvesting that cone, and what you do is you basically cut the whole plant down every year. So here we started harvesting in the middle of August. And what we do is we go through the yard, we cut the top of the plant right at that 18 feet tall where it hits the top of the trellis, and then we cut it around 3 feet above ground. And we take that whole plant mass then and we put it through the harvester. And basically the harvester strips the cones off. And so the cones go one way, and then the spent binds go kind of out and around. And then we take that and we just discard that in our compost pile. And we, you know, that's how every plant's done. Even on a, like, I have an acre in research, a research plot. It's about an acre north of town. But regardless of your size or acreage, that's how everybody harvests. So whether you're, you know, 600 acre farm out in Washington, there still everybody cuts the plant down, takes it, you know, either a small scale harvester like we have that we take to the field and harvest it there, or they'll take it to their shop, where essentially they have a stationary harvester set up that basically, once they have cut it and then they put it to the harvester, they don't touch it again. Everything's kind of conveyor on the large commercial side.
And then do the cones have to be dried?
Yeah. So you'll hear of, you know, fresh cones. So like a wet hop. Sometimes people will talk about a wet hop in a beer, especially around fall. There are, you know, some people that will make a fresh beer out of fresh, wet hops. So there's no drying. But that's a small amount for what most people want. And I should mention that for an acre, you're getting anywhere from 1,200 pounds of dried cones up to 2,400, 2,600 pounds of dried cones. You're getting a large yield per acre. That's per acre.
It's a productive plant.
Yeah. So each plant can weigh up to 20 pounds when it's ready to harvest, because when you're harvesting, you're looking for the cones when they're around 80% moisture, and you're drying them down to 8 to 10% moisture. So there's a lot of moisture loss. So that's where, you know, that dry pound comes, because, you know, getting back to the subject of fresh and wet hops. So the wet hops, if a brewer is interested in wet hops, then they're going to probably contract that out before you harvest so that they know that they're coming and you're ready for it. And you're just going to harvest. You're going to strip the cones from the plant, and then you're going to deliver those cones. And then dry hopping beer is the other thing that people will mention. And so with the fresh wet cone, it's a whole cone. It's just straight basically from the field. And with a dry hop, or then typically what happens is you go through the drying process, and then they will use the dry cone for a dry hop beer. If most people that want, most of your brewers, large scale, small scale, whether it's a craft or whether it's, you know, the commercialized large scale production facilities, they're going to want it dried. It's because, one, it stores. That's how it's going to store. And so what happens is, you know, you've harvested all, you have your cones, then you put them through a dryer. That, depending on your dryer setup, can take 6, 8, 12 hours. Then once they're dried, then you essentially are putting them in the cooler, and then Some brewers may take them hold cone for the, again, for that dry hop beer. But most of the time, again, they're going to go to another step where they get processed into pellets. Or for a large scale, they may get baled. And then, you know, either you'll just bale them and then sell whole bales, or they'll go to another facility where they'll be pelletized at some point. Most craft brewers use the pelletized hops. I mean, it's a labor intensive to, one, handle it because it's a lot of labor, because you have to go in the field. Everybody has to go in there and cut them all down. There are some ways to kind of speed it up slightly by having different kind of cutting machines kind of attached to like a truck or something going through the field that will help. But still, you have to have the manpower to go in and take them out of the farm. They go through the dryer, and then they'll go through a pelletizer, and then they get vacuum sealed into Mylar bags with a nitrogen flush, so basically get all the oxygen out so that for storage purposes. And then hopefully you have them sold and you start selling them out from there.
Amazing. Who knew all that went into hops, which is just the starting point of how they're used in beer.
Yeah, it's you know, I've been working with specialty crops, you know, my whole career, and I mean for a while now, and of all the crops I've worked with, I definitely think hops is one of the most challenging, but also, you know, it's a really fun crop because it grows, you know, 18 feet every year, and you can get that in 8 weeks, sometimes 6 weeks. So to me, it's just, you know, it's very intriguing. It's labor intensive throughout the whole process just to get, you know, that end goal of the beer. And considering it's not even the biggest ingredient in the beer, but it's what people think of most when they think about, you know, beer.
Yeah. So you have Hops Yard, I saw that it was called, that you do research on. And that's where you were talking about just harvest, recently finishing your harvest of the hops. Do students help with that?
Yeah, so it's at the Horticulture Research Station, so north of campus. And so there's, you know, the station itself is full of different fruits and vegetables. And then, you know, my hop yard is located on that along with, you know, all the other crops. So right now I have a grad student. She actually is a part of a Leopold funding helping with this project. So she's in charge of kind of the majority of that, basically, hop yard. And we're looking at some nitrogen rates, nitrogen forms, and kind of runoff, kind of looking at the more of the runoff in terms of, you know, what's going on, because there's a lot of variation in how much nitrogen to apply. And a lot of that's based on, you know, the different growing conditions where they're traditionally grown. More sandy soils obviously require more nitrogen, but it's one of those, does it require more nitrogen, or is it that it's not being applied at the appropriate time for the take up? So, you know, there's a lot of variation where in Iowa, our organic matter is higher, so we don't have to put on, I mean, there's reports of people putting on 300 pounds of nitrogen per acre per year. And so for us, we don't see that we need that much. But we're looking at kind of the effects of when people do put on that much nitrogen, what's going on in the soil profile. You know, so I have a third of the yard is Cascade hops, and then I have Chinook, which is a little bit it's a few rows. It's around 300 plants of Chinook. And then
these
are different cultivars. Yep. And that was kind of the initial part of the yard was just Cascade and Chinook. So those were put in 2015. And then 2016, I added two more rows of a cultivar trial with eight different cultivars that we're looking at to see which ones are more favorable for Iowa climates. You know, one of the things that kind of intrigued me about working with hops when I got to Iowa State was the fact that the flower is triggered at short day. So that way we don't really have to worry about a frost. So a lot of the other crops, so I work with apples, I work with grapes, basically all the other perennial fruits grown in Iowa. You know, with those, we're always concerned about a spring frost, especially if they're flowering, where with hops, we don't have to worry about that. I mean, there will be, you know, we may have a frost that knocks back the vegetative growth. And even if we had that happen at our last potential frost date, May 15th, we would still get a crop that year, which is nice for, you know, considering a lot of our other specialty crops. They would not be that lucky because once they're in flower and you get a frost, then you're kind of done.
So hops are not a big part of what's grown in Iowa right now.
No.
So one of the things you're interested in looking at is how hops can be grown perhaps commercially here in Iowa?
Yeah, we've got different grants through the Iowa Department of Ag Land Stewardship through their Specialty Crop Block Grant that's kind of helping fund some workshops that we've had and some extension trips We just got back from a trip where I took growers up to Michigan, and we toured Michigan hop yards. Michigan is currently fourth in the U.S. for hop production. They're a distant fourth from the top three, but they're still, you know, they're
Who's the top state?
The top three states are Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and then followed by Michigan. And so Michigan really started revamping their hop industry back in 2007, 2008. So they've been on the rise. And their climates are more similar to our climate. So that's why we took the group up there so that they could see all the different, you know, from small scale to large scale operations. We toured some different plant nurseries where they can source different products so that they know what to look for in terms of quality as well. So it's kind of, you know, just covered most of the production process from the field into the processing. So we visited processing facilities as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of helping to people understand that, you know, growing hops, there's more obstacles in your path between you and that endpoint of the brewer when you're growing hop. A lot of people are on contracts, so just getting into the market to try to sell your product is, you know, a little bit more difficult, as well as because of the proprietary cultivars that are coming out. It's more like club varieties. That's what we call them in apples. But some of the proprietary hops that are only allowed to grow in, you know, Washington or Washington, Oregon, Idaho. And those are some of the hops that a lot of the brewers want. So that is also an obstacle, as well as, you know, where if we go and, you know, plant apple trees 3 years later, assuming we're doing all the maintenance, pruning, you know, inputs, fertilizer, everything else, 3 years later, we're going to have a product. Well, it's a lot easier to go pick an apple and sell that fresh to the consumer versus when you grow hops. And then you have to go through the process of, okay, yes, harvesting, but then the drying, the pelletizing, just to get it to that next step. Mm-hmm. So that's where it's a little bit more challenging. So it's kind of my long way of saying that's kind of why we're trying to do more, you know, workshops and get people to understand that, you know, to think about it, because it is a large investment when you mm-hmm. start putting in a hop yard. And it's not something that you can just put in and then, you know, the market's going to open up, because it's a tight market, because the Pacific Northwest has owned that market mm-hmm. for so long. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to break through while we have an increase in the craft brewers,
here in Iowa. Yeah.
And some of them I've talked to, they're interested in local. But again, you know, it's one of those, you know, small scale operation versus large scale price points. Also knowing the quality, because there's a lot of differences that are still unknown that we're trying to mm-hmm. to look at. And mm-hmm. so with my research, that's what we're trying to look at is, you know, all these cultivars, we know essentially when they buy them to use in their beer, they want to know their alpha acid content, their beta acid content, and then the hop storage index. So that, you know, what's kind of that longevity in storage. So those are the three biggest things that they want, along as some want essential oil percentage as well. With alpha and beta, what we're looking at is to make sure that the cultivars that seem to grow well here are producing the levels that they're supposed to for the cultivars. Because mm-hmm. that's known, but it's just a matter of, you know, are they producing what they're supposed to here? Or I should say, are they developing the way the cultivar was bred to develop? As well as then there's those underlying kind of essential oils and flavor compounds that come out in different areas. So just kind of like you think of terroir with grapes. So there's a lot more research that's shown that, you know, different cultivars grown in different regions bring on different flavor compounds. Some of the brewers prefer the ones that are maybe grown in Michigan compared to the ones grown in, you know, mm-hmm. Washington. But that's where we have to figure it out.
Yeah, and they have to have something consistent, because people are expecting their beers, their products to taste a certain way reliably.
Exactly, because the, you know, the local consumer wants to, you know, they want their beer to mm-hmm. taste the way they're used to that beer tasting.
So you work through extension to get out and work with farmers or people who might be interested in growing hops, and also with the brewers, kind of bring those groups together?
Yes, so I try to as much as I can, because to me it's like, well, if you don't have a relationship with the brewers, they don't know what's going on in the production of the hops and vice versa. So I try to have a presence there as much as I can, as far as just trying to figure out, all right, well, you know, what do you need? Where's this going to fit? As well as making sure that they are aware as well that, you know, that just because they want a certain hop cultivar, it's not that we're not growing it because we don't want to. It's because proprietary, we can't. Mm-hmm. So it's also, you know, kind of talking with them and making sure, like, look, these, you know, hops, they grow well here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, is this a possibility for you to put in?
They would want to try.
Yep. And especially there are a lot of hops that are available from the USDA germplasm. And they're, you know, known, they're older, and some of them, but some brewers, because, you know, maybe they haven't brewed with them, mm-hmm. not for any reason other than they've, you know, started with what they start with. Yeah. And so some of them are interested, and they're more than willing to brew with some of the cultivars to see what can they get out of it. And a lot of the growers are, you know, doing that on their own, getting into the brewers markets as well and kind of being like, look, this is, you know, what I can offer you. These are, you know, kind of the characteristics of the alpha and the beta. Is there something that we can, you know, maybe do a test batch on? People are trying to work together as much as they can. And so I think the brewers are just as receptive as the hop growers. But it's definitely not just, you know, you can't just go plant 10 acres of hops, harvest them, and then take them to a brewer and say, hey, will you buy my hops? Because it's not going to work that way. There's so many new people that contact me each year that are putting in.
And these are people that are generally growing other crops as well, and hops is one of other things they grow, or are these people who are specializing in hops?
A lot of them are specializing in hops, so which I find, you know, kind of interesting. A lot of them, they may have grown up on a farm. Mm-hmm. Some of them, they've never, you know, really planted anything. Most of the hop growers, are new growers. To me, I kind of think of them similar to the grape industry in Iowa. A lot of the grape growers, the vineyards, they just grow grapes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were new to growing. So that's kind of similar to hops, where if you, you know, go visit an apple orchard, you'll see many different, you know, they usually have some vegetable crops there as well. They have different fruit trees, different, you know, berry crops. So it's more diverse. But with hops, generally they're just kind of specialized in hop production.
How did you get interested in that?
I knew I wanted to do stuff outside. I didn't grow up on a farm. I'm originally from Alabama, South Alabama. And I looked at horticulture and I kind of went in thinking landscape design. And then one thing led to another and I got more interested in the production side of things. And then I just got interested in more on the food crop side of things. And for, you know, kind of the research side of it is I like to see what I can do to kind of stress the plant without affecting the quality, you know. So what is the minimum irrigation? You know, what is the minimum inputs as far as fertilizer or pesticides, whatever it may be? And so that's kind of my focus, environmental stress physiology, is kind of what my research was kind of focused on in food crops.
And you became interested in hops only really after you got to Iowa a few years ago. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I was hired as a fruit extension specialist. I also have a teaching appointment in research as well, and because I work with the grape growers of Iowa. I started realizing, okay, well, hops is kind of a new crop that people were growing before I got here. So that was kind of something that intrigued me. So I kind of started, you know, a little bit of kind of hearing things. And then, I started looking into it. And they're quite similar in the way they, like the pest issues are quite similar. The management practices are quite similar. And so, it was just kind of looking around and then seeing that people were already doing it. And so I was like, well, I want to, you know, help these people out because a lot of them, you know, they didn't know where to get their information. I mean, you can look on the internet and you can get a lot of information, but sometimes you need that point contact, right? And so I can at least learn with them. So it was more of like, let me see what I can do to mitigate the risk. I think I was able to kind of start with a lot of them.
Have you ever tasted a beer made with hops you've grown?
Not that I've grown. But I have tasted, there's been a few breweries that have made beer in the past couple years out of Iowa-grown hop. And there's one grower I helped harvest one year because it was my first year and I was trying to get a sense. So I went and helped him harvest and then I drank that beer. So, kind of
so
had that
some,
that.
Some beer that was made from hops that you harvested.
Yeah, so that aspect, is, you know.
That's cool.
Right,
yeah.
But there are a few that, you know, breweries around that are producing beer with Iowa-grown hops.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to see more and more Iowa-grown hops in beer. Yeah, it's kind of fun to see it from the field all the way into the beer.
Well, thank you for explaining it all to us.
Well, thank you.
That was Diana Cochran from the Horticulture Department at ISU. Dr. Cochran also told me about other uses for hops. Hops are used in some sleep aids and in Tom's natural products. They are being studied in breast cancer research and as a hormone replacement. And you can make lovely wreaths from hop vines, she also told me.
Phenology is recording nature's happenings when they occur. The first firefly of spring or the last hummingbird of autumn are noted in a journal for future reference and comparisons from year to year. And as Lee Searles with White Rock Conservancy writes, phenology is the study of natural cycles in the lives of living animals and plants. Today's phenology is about dragonflies in Iowa. Seemingly from out of nowhere, a few dragonflies over the tall corn manifested into a swarm of winged wonders. Their numbers exploded, darting, directing, zooming, zigging, zipping, and now hovering, as many as a jillion joined each other in the moment of movement through the air we breathe, the sun glinting through their wings, passing along coded messages of life. The dragonfly is an insect belonging to the order Odonata and are named because the hind wing is broader than the forewing. Adult dragonflies are characterized by large, multifaceted eyes, two pairs of strong, transparent wings, sometimes with colored patches, and an elongated body. Dragonflies can be mistaken for the related group damselflies, which are similar in structure, though usually lighter in build. However, dragonfly wings are right angle to or straight out from their body, and the damselfly wings are swept back or parallel to their bodies. Fossils of very large dragonfly ancestors in the Proto-Odonata are found from 325 million years ago. These had wingspans up to 3 feet. Dragonflies are predators both in their aquatic larval stage, when they are known as nymphs, and as adults. Several years of their lives are spent as nymphs, living in fresh water. The adults may be on the wing for just a few days or weeks. They are fast, agile flyers, sometimes migrating across oceans, and often live near water. Loss of wetland habitat threatens dragonfly populations around the world. Dragonflies are flat-out terrifying if you're a gnat, mosquito, or other small bug. They don't simply chase down their prey. Instead, they snag them from the air with calculated aerial ambushes. Dragonflies can judge the speed and trajectory of prey target and adjust their flight to intercept prey. They're so skilled that they have up to 95% success rate when hunting. Not only are they agile, but they're fast, with some species reaching a top speed of 18 miles per hour. Between the speed, distance, and flexibility when hunting, dragonflies are one of the most exceptional flyers on the planet. If you look at a dragonfly's head, you might notice one thing in particular, or rather 30,000 things in particular. The area of the Odonata's head is comprised primarily of its enormous compound eyes, which contain 30,000 facets, each bringing in information about the insect's surroundings. Dragonflies have near 360-degree vision, with just one blind spot directly behind them. This extraordinary vision is one reason why they're able to keep a watch on a single insect within a swarm and go after it while avoiding mid-air collisions with other insects in the swarm. Dragonflies lay their eggs in water, and when the larvae hatch, they live underwater for up to 6 years. They'll molt up to 17 times as they grow and get ready to head to the surface and transform into the dragonflies we see in the air. You can visit dragonfly sanctuaries around the world, like the Dragonfly Pond in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and our own Ada Hayden Lake has two researchers, Wolf Osterich and Dr. Irv Kloss, who are documenting dragonflies and damselflies upon that body of water. The dragonfly does an amazing job of helping humans by controlling the population of insects, especially those that bug us, such as mosquitoes and biting flies. They also inspire us to create new technology based on their incredible skills at flight and vision. The least we humans can do to return the favor is support the conservation of their wetland habitats so they can continue on for another 300 million years. In almost every part of the world, the dragonfly symbolizes change, transformation, adaptability, and self-realization. The change that is often referred to has its source in mental and emotional maturity and understanding the deeper meaning of life. The dragonfly normally lives most of its life as a nymph or immature. It flies only for a fraction of its life. This symbolizes and exemplifies the virtue of living in the moment and living life to the fullest. By living in the moment, you are aware of who you are, where you are, what you are doing, what you want, and what you don't, and to make informed choices on a moment-to-moment basis. The eyes of the dragonfly symbolizes the uninhibited vision of the mind and the ability to see beyond the limitations of the human self. Dragonflies can be a symbol of self that comes with maturity. They can symbolize going past self-created illusions that limit our growth and ability to change. The dragonfly means hope, change, and love. Migration season is upon us, but it isn't just the birds that are migrating. We know that monarch butterflies make a complex annual migration, but the record for the longest insect migration, twice the distance of the monarchs, is held by a dragonfly, the wandering glider, or the smoky ruby spot. You gotta love their colorful names of these jeweled wonders. In mid-September, winds coming from the north create good conditions for observing dragonflies migrating south. Migrating only during daylight hours, darners can fly more than 60 miles a day. And any day now, an afternoon or an evening, migration of a few jillion dragonflies will flit and sweep through this farmstead where I live. Since it used to be a marsh, I'm thinking their visit has been ongoing since the beginning of dragonflies, and maybe some of those prehistoric winged ones with 3-foot wingspans. The lucky dragonflies will be making it to Florida, Texas, Mexico, or the Caribbean for a few weeks of egg laying before they die. Their progeny will be the ones heading north next spring. And that's our phenology for today about dragonflies in Iowa. Background music is John Barleycorn Must Die by Traffic. And this is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. Become a member or find the donate button at our website, khoifm.org.
And the tinker, he can't mend kettle nor pots without a little barley coal.
We've been joined in the studio by Crystal Davis from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau. Thanks for being with us, Crystal.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
You are going to be talking with us this morning about the community grants program that the Bureau offers to the community. What's the purpose of that?
Yeah, so since 2007, we've been having an Ames Convention Visitors Bureau Community Grant Program. And what that is, it's a way for our lodging community to give back to Ames and some of the events. And so what it is, it's a program that anyone who's hosting an event here in Ames in Central Iowa can apply. You don't need to be a nonprofit. You can be a public organization as well. And you can apply for some funds that can help enhance an existing event that you might already be putting on or help put on a brand new event. And so it's really a way to help bring visitors to Ames and experience what we have, and as well as encourage local residents to come out and experience maybe an event they haven't been to before.
You mentioned a little bit about who can apply. Maybe say more about that and how to apply.
Right. So who can apply? Funds are available just to help, like I mentioned before, to develop events and activities that help improve the quality of life for Ames residents and have the potential to attract visitors here. And applications can be accepted from public and private organizations who demonstrate the ability to complete and host the proposed event or activity. And we have applications right on our website, so you can go to thinkames.com. Click on the tab that says About Us, and then on that page, we've got a whole section dedicated to the community grant program. And so we've got an application. We've got information on types of events that have been recipients of community grants before, so that might help some folks. So some of them you are, I'm sure, all familiar with, like Summerfest in Campus Town, Dancing with the Story County Stars, The Amazing Grace Lemonade Race, Winterfest at Iowa State University, Reggie's Sleepout here in Ames, the Ames Fireworks are a recipient of this grant money. Just recently they did that bell casting at ISU where they're making a miniature version of the Campanile. They were a recipient. The Pride Block Party, ISU Block and Bridal Club Livestock Shows. If you're around downtown this past weekend, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market is a recipient as well. So just a wide variety of events that have come forward and said, we've got a great event, but maybe we need a little help with marketing or advertising, or maybe they need some funds to help help with some, like a race. You might need funds for the T-shirts that everyone loves so that the registration fees can go towards the purpose and back to the charity that they're raising funds for.
So you don't fund the whole event. There needs to be other funding, but
correct.
You supplement that.
Correct. So we like to say we don't fund staffing. We won't fund if you need a new door to your office, so to speak, or if you need equipment or infrastructure. But we anything that can help enhance the event, such as like marketing, advertising, helping to pay for we know some groups have used the money to help pay for the entertainment so it can be free, so folks don't have to pay to come listen to the band. So, yeah, it goes for wide reasons.
Are there specific criteria that you use to evaluate the grant applications?
Right. So a big thing for us is the event needs to be open to the public. It does not matter if you are charging a fee, like, say, for a race, or it's a free event. We just say it needs to be open to the public. We need you to be able to create a positive perception of Ames and improve the quality of life. You know, is there an ability with your event to attract visitors, maybe enhance their stay? Is there diversity and uniqueness to the event? And does the event appeal to a broad-based audience? So it kind of goes back to that. It's open to the public. It's not just for your membership. It's open for everyone.
And is there a committee or who decides which grants to fund?
Yeah, good question. So we have a few board members from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, as well as we have community members that serve on the board. So no staff is on the committee, and they take this very seriously. They review every application, every detail, and really are very thoughtful about who is going to receive the grant funds, and they really do a good job of working through that process.
And where does the money come from to fund these?
Right. So a portion of the hotel motel tax is used. So that's why we say it's a good opportunity. Our lodging community wants to give back, and so it's really a good thing that they can do and say that they do for the Ames community. So it comes from there.
So you want to see some kind of payoff if groups apply multiple years? Do they need to show how they used it and that it had the desired impact?
Right, absolutely. So there is a final report that needs to come back. And so it just kind of shows how you use the money. You know, we've had some grant application or recipients who come back and say, you know what, we've changed it so we're not using this band, but maybe we're trying something else. And that's all fine. They kind of keep us in the loop. And so, yeah, we like to see, you know, were they able to have a return on investment? Do they think more visitors came? One of our great examples is Actors here in town has been a multi-year recipient, and they used the money to help fund their reception that they used to help season tickets. And they can say that every year their season ticket sales have gone up, kind of guarantees that they've got performers and an audience. And so we're really pleased that these funds help them secure and continue on that great performances that they do. Great for the community.
So it's nice when you can actually see the impact,
absolutely,
the positive impact that the grants are having.
Right.
And KHOI, I know, has been a recipient of a grant for our birthday party, which just happened past August.
I know. What a great example of how the community grants were funded. And it was a success.
It was
a great
day. Yeah. It was wonderful. And yesterday, the Octagon Arts Festival was funded in part by one of these community grants.
Yep. So they were a current recipient of this year's community grant funds. Friday night, Season at Stevens, their performing arts series, had their 50th celebration Friday night. They were also a recipient of some funds. And we have some other ones coming up in October.
Coming up, yeah. Tell us about those.
So a big one, I hope you've heard, the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibit that's coming downtown. It'll open on September 29th and runs through November 11th.
We had Cindy Hicks on last week talking about that.
Hometown teams. Uh-huh. So they're a great example, too, of a group that has several organizations working together to bring that event here. And so they are recipient of the community grant fund, and they're opening September 29th. October 4th is their opening night with their tailgate downtown, right here on 400 block of Douglas. So be sure to check that out. And they'll be at the Octagon Center for the Arts, the Ames Historical Society, Design on Main, and the Ames Public Library. And so, what a great great opportunity to have that traveling exhibit here. Run for the Roses is a race, an annual race that's put on with the Ames Running Club and one of the sororities on campus. Great collaboration. They are also a recipient, and they'll be hosting that race on October 7th. So that's another good example of how the funds are used. So,
any other things coming up that receive
funding?
Oh,
yeah, it's fall. We're busy.
All right, you can tell us about a couple of others.
Yep. So, as you know, Ames Farmers Market and North Grand Farmers Market, just a few more weeks, folks, so get out there on Saturdays. I just want to make note on Wednesday, October 3rd, the Downtown Healthy Estate Walk will be happening, so from 12 to 1 p.m. So it's the 8th Annual Mayor's Downtown Healthy Estate Walk, and it'll start at City Hall, so be sure to join that. I know we're south out at the Golden Aspen Park, so we also do our own version of a walk that day down there, so it's a great opportunity to participate as a community. October 6th, Crafts and Drafts in Campustown, so that's 1 to 6 o'clock. There's live music, crafts, and drafts. So it's a fun way to do some creative activities while you're listening to some music, and there'll be food trucks and carts and some ciders, and so a great event that the public's invited to there. And the Fall Festival, so be sure to go on Sunday, October 7th out to McFarland Park from 3 to 6 p.m. and bring a blanket and your chair, enjoy some great music by the Vinyl Vagabonds. There'll be a food vending there, picnic, and just enjoy the fall colors that we have right here in our backyard. So that's some things to look forward to. I do like to mention Story Theater Company of Ames. They're having their next show October 18th through the 21st. You know this is put on by the kids, the youth, and what a great opportunity here at their Black Box Theater on South Dayton. And they're doing The Goonie Bird Green and Her True Life Adventures.
That is a lot going on this fall, and it's a lot that the Community Grants Program has had a hand in promoting.
Right.
I think Ames people can see that money is being put to use very effectively. Do you have something else you want? I see you have another paper there. You want to share something else with us?
I just wanted to share some of the success with the community grant program. So in 2018 alone, we're, the program has funded 31 events and at $92,000 in funding spread across those 31 events. And since the program's been going since 2007, they've funded 254 events with over 630,000 funds used to help promote events and help enhance what's going on here in the community and help attract visitors to come here. So we're really proud of that and think that's a great, great testament to Ames and all the great things we have to do here.
And what's the average amount that a group requests or receives? Do you have a sense?
It can go a wide range. It can go, some group might ask for $500 or as low, you know, you can ask for what you need, all the way up to over $10,000 or more.
Like the fireworks probably are one of the costlier ones that might need more help.
Correct. So you just put in what you think you might need, and then the grant committee does work through that. And not everyone gets everything they've asked for, but they do their best to fund as many as possible with the greatest amount of money. So it's a wide range.
So when people apply, they need to present a budget, submit a budget, and a description of how the money will be used.
Right. So they're going to kind of tell a little bit about the event that they're wanting to host. Who do they expect will attend the event? How will this event improve the quality of life for Ames residents? Will it encourage others to travel here to visit our fair city? They just tell a little bit like how we use the funds, how we use it to enhance your event. We also ask, you know, if you didn't receive the funds, what would happen to your event? Maybe you couldn't host it or, you know, are there other things you could do? How will you promote the event? And we do ask for a little bit of information about the budgeting sources of other funding and that sort of thing. So, yeah.
The deadline is coming up.
It's coming up. So Friday, October 12th at 12 noon. So that 12 noon is important. And we do hold fast to that. So there is plenty of time. You can go to our website, thinkames.com, click about us, look for the community grant information. You can always call us. We have some great staff members who are great resources for this community grant process. And so we're glad to talk talk you through it on the phone or talk to you in person if you'd like to come see us.
For groups, yeah.
And they'll just, we'll really walk through it with you and help answer questions. And
give you an idea if your group would qualify.
Sure,
perhaps.
We can and help you mm-hmm. fine tune that
craft
application.
It. Yeah.
So then call our office at 232-4032. ThinkGames.com, again, is the website. And October 12th is the deadline.
And we'll put the link to that website up on our website when we post this show. Thanks very much.
Thanks
for filling us in on this, Crystal. I've been speaking with Crystal Davis from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, and she's given us everything we need to know about the Ames Community Grants Project. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard We Weren't Born to Follow by Bon Jovi. Thanks to our reporters and all the guests on today's show. Thanks to Joy Beadleston for the interview with Bobby Dennis, to Pat Schlaubaum for the Dragonfly Phonology, and also to Diana Cochran from ISU and Crystal Davis from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau. If you value the stories and interviews that we bring you on Local Talk, why not become a member of KHOI? You can do it online, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button or call 515-292-2878 or come by the station at 410 Douglas. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio. Support for KHOI is provided in part by the Iowa State Center, presenting Kenny G, November 28th at 8 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu. That's center.iastate.edu.